During the course of this narrative, I have omitted various little odds and ends that I intended to include, and I don't know any thing to do about that right now, except to perhaps, if important enough, insert those little things as I go along now. One of them that comes to mind at the moment is the fact that only a few hundred yards from our campground at Dobadura, in the trees, was parked a trailer, meaning a semi-trailer without a tractor part, just the trailer, but a vehicle of that description and size. And they had some enlisted men down there, I think maybe only two, busy doing something, and they had an engine running, a motor running all the time, I remember. And one day, some of us went down there to see what was going on. Well, as it turned out, what they were doing was making oxygen. I don't know whether making is the right word, but I'm going to use it because I don't know what the right word is. That never occurred to any of us to give any thought to where the oxygen that the air crews used on a daily basis came from. I guess we just assumed it came from the United States, if indeed anybody ever gave it any thought. But the fact was that the Air Corps had this unit which was set up to do nothing but make oxygen. How they did it, I don't know, but they had a what was probably a diesel engine of some kind which ran all day long. And outside of the trailer, lying on the ground, was a huge, enormous, big canvas bag. That's all I can call it. And as they made oxygen, that bag was slowly inflated. And I guess they compressed it and put it in the steel tanks in which you ordinarily see oxygen today, and it was distributed around to the various flying units. After having used up my month's leave in mostly in Harrisonburg, aside from the amount that I used in Hinsdale with Tom and Betty, and also I might mention when while I was in Harrisonburg, I took a trip of several days and went down to Roanoke and visited Grace and Anna and Mickey and David for a few days. Then at some time or other, towards the end of the leave, I went up to New York and stayed at the apartment of a friend, Lizzie Borish, and was reunited, you might say, there with Hanson, Catherine, Jack, and Eleanor. When I came back to the United States, probably I should think while I was at Hamilton Field that afternoon, instead of giving my home address as Harrisonburg, Virginia, I gave Jack's address in New Jersey. And the reason I did this was that I suspected, rightly as it turned out, that if I gave address in Virginia, when it came time to go back to duty, I would be assigned to the southeast area, which probably meant Florida or Georgia or someplace like that. And I preferred to be assigned up in the northeast. And As it turned out, as I said, I was right about that. They assigned me to the rehabilitation center, or whatever it was called, in Atlantic City. What the Air Corps had done was to take over one or more big hotels on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, and they turned them into sort of rest and recreation areas. And when I finally reported for duty there, sometime in March 1944, and expected everything to be quite military, I was greatly surprised when I walked into the hotel and went to check in. The officer at the desk said, Well, here's your room, Captain. You just go on up there, and here's the key. And when you feel like it, we would appreciate it very much if you would come to room so-and-so, and we'll arrange a schedule for you. But don't be in any hurry about it. Just take your time, and so on. So here I was assigned to a very nice hotel room. And, of course, there was nobody in this hotel but Air Corps people returning from overseas, and certain people stationed there to cater to their wishes, I suppose. We ate in the dining room, hotel dining room, and had a very leisurely life. But they did have various things scheduled, including a long series of very detailed physical examination tests of one kind or another. And I don't know what all else. The only thing I remember of that nature, other than the physical thing, was a psychiatric examination. And I remember that very well, because I walked into the psychiatrist's office, and on his desk he had a beautiful little model P-51 on his desk there, and I expressed great enthusiasm for that model, and he grinned and he said, you'd like to fly that, would you? And I said, indeed I would. And he said, well, it doesn't look like to me there's much wrong with you. And that was the end of my psychiatric exam. Well, Paul Slocum was there, and John Miller, and I expect we spent some rather drunken evenings at that place. I remember, I have a picture of one where John Miller is sitting at the bar with his eyes quite glazed, and I don't know that Paul Slocum's or mine were any better. We stayed there until the 20th of March, at which time we were assigned at various places, but Paul Slocum, John Miller, and I were all assigned to the 1st Air Force at Mitchell Field, Long Island. And when we reported to Mitchell Field, the 1st Air Force immediately, that is to say within an hour or less, reassigned us to the 1st Fighter Command. Mitchell Field was the headquarters of the 1st Air Force, which meant that there was also on that base the headquarters of the 1st Bomber Command and the headquarters of the 1st Fighter Command. And so we were assigned to the 1st Fighter Command, and I had not been there more than a day or 2 days at the most before I came down with malaria. All the time we were in New Guinea, we took some pills. They were called Atabrin, and they were yellow pills, and they turned you yellow. And when I first came home, although grown-ups were too polite to say anything, children would always ask you why you were so yellow, because it turns your skin sort of yellow and your eyeballs yellow. Anyway, once I got home, I quit taking the Ativan, and with the result that at Mitchell Field, I came down with my first case of malaria and was taken to the hospital and put there. I was supposed to have been transferred to a sort of P-47 training base at what was called Hills Grove Airfield in Providence, Rhode Island. It was really the Providence, Rhode Island Municipal Airport, but the Air Corps had taken over part of it and had barracks and stuff there. Anyway, before I could go to Hills Grove, I ended up in the hospital and spent a while there, perhaps as long as 2 weeks or something. Then they wanted to send me up to some sort of convalescent center in upstate New York, but I begged them not to do that, that I didn't want to go up there. I wanted to go back to flying, and they went along with that and gave me orders then to go on up to Hills Grove. And I remember the morning I left, which is very, very early in the morning, barely after daylight, and it was snowing like mad. But this DC-3, a commercial airliner, was took off anyway from, I guess, LaGuardia, and flew over to Hills Grove, where it made regular stops anyway. And I got out and was then a part of that base. And, of course, Paul Slocum, Johnny Miller were both there and sort of clued me in on what went on. And at Hills Grove, what we mainly did was checked out in P-47s. And, of course, I had flown the P-47 once before, but that was all. Whereas here we got thorough training and indoctrination in that airplane. And some interesting little things happened. I remember one time I was, some people were getting gunnery training. I didn't get any, but wasn't supposed to either. But some people were, and part of their duties, they'd grab up pilots wherever they could find them and assign them to towing a tow target, as it was called, which was a long sleeve which you towed behind the airplane, and people practicing aerial gunnery would make passes at it and fire on it. And you had to do this out over the ocean so you wouldn't hit anybody. I described this a little bit way back when I talked about our gunnery training at Eglin Field, Florida. Well, the only time I did this, I was quite surprised at it, because towing that target turned out to be very hard work, not for me, but for the P-47. And the airplane, it held it down, the speed way down, and worked the engine quite hard. In fact, the only time in my life I ever remember having to fly with the cowl flaps partly open just to keep the cylinder head temperature within limits. And the cable that attached the target to the airplane was springy enough that it would stretch and then finally come to the end of its limit and contract then. And every time it did that, it would slow the airplane down, and then you'd pick up a little more speed, and it would stretch and contract again, pull it back. It was a rather unpleasant duty, as a matter of fact. And when you were through, you flew at a fairly low altitude over the runway and jettisoned the target, which fell down on the runway, and people went out there and got it and came on land. That is the only time I ever did that. Once was plenty for me. We also had some night flying to do. Of course, none of us had flown at night since we left flying school. That was rather fun. But I remember the first night I went flying, I went with somebody, Captain somebody or other, and I flew on his wing. And he took it in his head to go down to New York City. via the Connecticut coast. Well, we were going along there quietly and minding our own business in the dark, and suddenly there was several explosions near us, and I remember saying to whoever it was I was flying with, what was that? And he says it looked like ground fire to me, and apparently somebody overheard all this because somebody said, I don't know whether they addressed us as P-47s or what. They said, what is your position? And we said we were over New Haven or someplace. And they said, well, get out of there. You're being fired at. And indeed, we were in a wry, W-R-Y, sort of way. It amused me to think what would have happened had I been shot down over the coast of Connecticut a month after getting back from New Guinea. Anyway, we took care after that to stay away from the coast. We had a good deal of fun with the fact that we had these marvelous VHF radios and static-free and perfect, practically, communication between airplanes and between airplanes and the ground. And the great plethora of landing fields all over the place, and nice ones too. While I was at Hillsgrove, I bought a car. A used 1941, I think, Plymouth two-door sedan. Very nice car it was, too. One time while I was there, I took off and went up to Boston to see Aunt Toby, and another time I took off one weekend and went up to Wrentham and visited Father Cowell. Now, that can't be right. Well, I think it was right. No, it can't be right. That must have been later. I did do that, but it couldn't have been this early. Anyway, we had a lot of, or a certain amount of instrument flying to do, and they insisted on your getting an instrument rating, which all of that was done in an AT-6. The guy who took me up for my instrument check was another captain. He had been in Europe. And a very nice fella, and we were kind of friends, and not especially, but a little bit, and he was always kind of, how shall I say, he acted in a big brotherly sort of way to me, that's what he did. And when somebody came up to him one day and said, I want you to take Dilworth up and give him his instrument check, he said, I don't want to fly with that little shit. Anyway, he did. And he passed me. Well, when we'd finished the training program at Hillsgrove, we were transferred then to various places. Paul Slocum was transferred to first Air Force headquarters at Mitchell Field. Johnny Miller was transferred, I forget where. I think maybe down at Dover, Delaware, where the 1st Fighter Command had a base. And I was transferred to Bradley Field in Connecticut, which was over on the west side of the Connecticut River between Hartford, Connecticut and Springfield, Massachusetts. Bradley Field, incidentally, is still Bradley Field and is now also known as the Hartford-Springfield International Airport, and has long passed out of military hands. But at that time, it was strictly a 1st Fighter Command AAFBTU, which stood for Army Air Force Training Unit. Anyway, what they did there was to check out newly graduated second lieutenants, newly graduated from flying school, that is, lieutenants in P-47s, and give them instruction in the P-47 and in formation flying and high altitude flying and stuff like that. Instrument flying too, incidentally. So this took place sometime during the first 2 weeks in May, and the weather by that time was very nice. And I drove my little car over to Bradley Field and checked in, and was told to go see the director of training, who was a man named Al Aiken, a major. And I remember his telling me, he said, Captain, he said, there isn't much I can do for you. He said, captains around here are a dime a dozen. And what he was telling me was that I should not expect duty commensurate with my rank, because they didn't have any such duties. And most everybody at that base was strictly concerned with training, and most of the pilot returnees, like myself, almost all of them were captains, just as I was, were assigned as flight instructors for the second lieutenants. Well, that just suited me fine. That's all I wanted anyway. And I had no complaint to offer on that score. So I was assigned to one of the various training squadrons. We had a bunch of P-47s assigned to us, and we also had one BT-13, which I flew a few times, though not much. I forget at the time who the squadron commander was. I think it was a sort of gruff, good-hearted fella named McDonald, but it doesn't much matter. I was directly under the supervision of a flight commander, another captain by the name of Neen, K-N-E-E-N, I think. Very nice fella and very competent man he was, too. And so we had these programs that were all laid out for these trainees. We were carefully instructed not to call them trainees. They were brand new second lieutenants, and by that time we're quite sick of being called trainees, and so we didn't in their presence refer to them, I hope, as trainees. We weren't supposed to. But they got a certain amount of so-called transition flying, which means they were checked out in the P-47 and given a certain number of hours just to fly it around by themselves and get used to it. And then they were given formation flying, and they were given instrument flying, and they were given night flying and night formation flying and high altitude flying. And they spent a fair amount of time there before they had finished the course. They were also given some gunnery training, but that was not given to them at Bradley Field. They transferred somewhere else for that, down on Long Island, if my memory serves me. I can't remember all the bases that the First Fighter Command had at that time, but they had Bradley Field, and they had Hills Grove, and they had a base out at the east end of Long Island. They had a base in Dover, Delaware. They had a couple bases in North Carolina, and they had a base in South Carolina. And of all places, Fort Knox, Kentucky, which has a big airfield, and it was under the jurisdiction of First Fighter Command. Anyway, all this training business was very I don't know what word to use, but I liked it. We had a lot to do to get these kids used to flying formation properly. At some point in this narrative, previously I told you what formation flying was like as taught in flying school, and there you were supposed to fly close to your flight leader and never take your eyes off of him. Well, that's what these kids had been taught too, and at Bradley Field we had to go about unteaching them that and trying to teach them to not fly close, but to fly far enough away from the flight leader that they had time to look around and pay attention to other things and not run the risk of having a collision with him. And this was very hard to get through those kids' heads. They would tend, on, in the beginning at least, to get up there and glue their eyes right on the flight leader and never budge. Well, that's what we didn't want them to do, because in combat, that could be fatal. And eventually, of course, we were able to do that. But I remember one time I took three kids up, and I deliberately took them out to the end of Cape Cod, which is, geographically speaking, and especially from the air, unique. It doesn't look like any other place I know. And I came back and asked one of those kids where we had been, and he said, "Well, I don't know, sir." He said, "Out over Massachusetts, somewhere, I guess." Well, obviously he hadn't looked at the ground, or he would have known where he had been, and that's why I asked him that. I knew damn well he didn't. That I could tell they weren't paying attention to the ground. And anyway, we eventually got him used to that. A difficult thing to learn, and this was. This was something I'd had to learn myself when I came back to the United States, because I didn't have all that much training in it either, and that was high-altitude flying. Now, you could get a P-40 up to 30,000 feet, but it wasn't worth anything up there, and I never heard of anybody in New Guinea ever trying to fly a mission at any such altitude as that. It would have been advantageous if you could, but the truth is, the nearer an airplane gets to its ceiling, more wishy-washy it becomes. It is slow to react to controls. It stalls easily. It you can't do anything much with it up there. If you breathe hard, it'll lose 10 feet. I'm exaggerating, of course, but what I'm saying is that the airplane is very unstable at those altitudes. And but with the P-47, which was turbo supercharged, hell, you could go to 40,000 feet. And at 40,000 feet, a P-47 acted much like a P-40 at 30. But we would take these kids up to 30,000, 35,000, and we wanted them to get used to flying formation at those altitudes. And we did that, and I never forget my surprise. The first time I was up at some altitude like that with a formation, and I looked over at this kid flying off my wing, and I thought, Jesus Christ, he's on fire. And the smoke was pouring out of the rear end of that airplane, and but as we were in a turn, and as we turned and got in a different relation to the sun, I suddenly realized that wasn't smoke, it was contrails. His contrail was exhaust vapor. But it was my first experience at ever seeing that stuff in real life. Of course, I'd seen plenty of it in movies, B-17s and all that. But I'd never actually set eyes on it, and it was a lesson to me. One of the things that took place during this period happened almost the first day or so that I was assigned to this training squadron, and I went up on a flight with a student. And in the middle of things, two other P-47s buzzed us in the air and took us quite by surprise. And, well, that was all right. But when I got back down and landed and went in the alert check, one of the other instructors, who was himself a second lieutenant and who had not been overseas, but was nevertheless assigned as a flight instructor, and we had several of those people, he came over and apologized to me and said that he was the one who had done the buzzing, and he said, if I'd known who you were, I would never have done it, sir. I'm very sorry. And I was rather taken aback.